So first of all, thank you very much for agreeing to sit down with us
You're
for this
welcome.
interview. As we've discussed, the purpose of this interview is mostly to talk about the period in which replica symmetry breaking was formulated, from roughly 1975 to 1995. But in the to get to this, we have a few sort of background questions that will get us to this epoch. In particular, right, I've read Michel Maréchal's recent profile that he wrote about you, and from this we understand that in the early 70s you were particularly interested in the interplay between renormalization group and numerical simulations in statistical physics, right? That was your main scientific thrust at that point. Can you describe how you became aware and kept abreast of the theoretical developments, right? How these conversations or those insights came.
Well, you mean now the critical phenomena and renormalization group?
Yes.
That I became aware in my thesis already when my thesis advisor, he was an experimentalist, Helmut Rauch. He made some experiments with polarized neutrons and let a beam of polarized neutrons pass through a ferromagnet, where these polarized neutrons experience a change of the spin orientation, and he heated the ferromagnet and noticed that when the ferromagnet passes through the Curie temperatures, there was a strong anomaly in the signal. And he asked me in my thesis that I should try to find out about what was a cause for this phenomenon. And I then started to learn about critical phenomena in 1967 from articles which just in that year appeared. There was a famous article by Kardanov et al. In Reviews of Modern Physics and by Michael Fischer in Reports on Progress in Physics. And then I found also a lot of original literature, and so I discovered that this was really a boiling field with very interesting questions. And so then I thought about how could I do something about finding out about spin correlations in a ferromagnet, which might be relevant for these experiments, at least when one thinks about small angle scattering of neutrons, which is not the same thing as the measurement which was done, but related to it. And my PhD advisor, he was quite happy about the idea that I should look into this problem in more detail, and he was expecting that there would be something interesting later for the experiment too, which in the end, I contributed nothing to explain his particular experiment, which was at a too small reactor anyway, because one needs for neutron scattering a lot of intensity. And in the direct beam, where you have the transmitted neutrons and the scattered neutrons intermixed, you can very hardly interpret in any quantitative manner. So the experiment did not really profit, but I had a nice topic for my PhD, and I tried to do some systematic high temperature series expansion for a real ferromagnet. You have to do this with Heisenberg spins and not with Ising spins. But then I noticed that this was extremely difficult to go to high order, and I looked for something else. And since I had heard about the Monte Carlo method, I started doing some Monte Carlo simulations on spin correlations in Ising and Heisenberg classical ferromagnets. And I was at that time the first to try to calculate such spin correlation functions with that method. And we got the first publication already 1 year later in 1968. And in 1969, I finished my PhD. And about the state of the art I actually learned in 1970 when I had the opportunity to attend this famous Fiemi-sama school at the Lake of Como. So these are the sort of things which are also talked about in this exposé which Michel Maréchal wrote. And then I was working a couple of years on phase transitions, most prominently in magnetic system. And this, in this context, I heard also for the first time in 1972 about the strange experiments from the group of Maidosh and co-workers on a cusp and the magnetic susceptibility in alloys such as copper with a few parts of a percent manganese and related materials, and also at Jülich, they had done experiments on europium sulfide, a ferromagnet with nearest neighbor ferromagnetic exchange, next nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic exchange, and diluting this with non-magnetic strontium ions was enough in order to also produce a spin glass phase, as this then was called. And originally I felt that this was a rather strange phenomenon. I did not start to work on this immediately, but when I was 6 months as a visiting scientist.
So before we, so I don't mean to, we will get there. I just wanted to take a step back. And first, can you show me where your microphone is to make sure that?
Yeah.
And can you tap it so that I can make sure that this is the right noise? Yeah, that's good. Okay, perfect. Okay. So the question I want to get to before then, So in the early 1970s, when you were working on trying to understand finite size scaling or starting to understand finite size scaling, was this mostly from you reading the literature that you were finding out about the work of Ken Wilson, or were you attending meetings, or were you?
The interest in finite size scaling came about first, in a very naive way, when you do this Monte Carlo simulation with the computers were very slow. So we started in the latest 6 × 6 × 6. And of course, you find that everything and then in the vicinity of the Curie temperature is very much smeared out and rounded. And so the next thing to try was to do 8 × 8 × 8, and then you see it was already sharpening up somewhat. And the largest data which we then have in this publication of 1969 is 10 × 10 × 10. And so this already calls that, and then you read in the literature that really thermodynamics deals with the thermodynamic limit, particle number to infinity. And so it was immediately clear that one had to extrapolate this to the thermodynamic limit. And when I attended this Fermi summer school, then actually Michael Fischer was in his lecture talking about this effect in terms of what happens to the specific heat peak of easing lattices in two dimensions. And there you can, with the transfer matrix method, calculate the rounding of the singularities exactly. And so he made then some phenomenological extensions of this, how one could understand this. And in his write-up, I don't know whether he really said this at the conference, but in his write-up 1 year later, then there was also the statement that the linear dimension has to be compared with the correlation length. And at this Varena summer school, there were some lectures on renormalization group methods given hold by Jona Lasinia from Rome. But this was extremely abstract. The connection, how this could help anything with critical phenomena was completely unclear. And in this time when this conference was held, nobody, and there were very clever people like Michael Fischer, Leo Kadanoff, Pierre Hohenberg, and so on and on. Nobody did know about Ken Wilson's work. This was, at this time, top secret, and Ken Wilson knew why he didn't talk about it before he had published something. And so in this way, his detailed paper in the Fifth Ref were really existed before he then started to collaborate with Michael Fischer on this epsilon expansion and titled Critical Exponents in 3.99 Dimensions. So this came really afterwards, and so the finite size scaling was completely independent and earlier than the randomization group. And of course, when the randomization group existed, then it was a very nice way of interpreting why this should work. And so this came together confluently later.
I see, thank you. And then you, later on, you mentioned the work of Canella and Majdash that was published in 1972. In notes that you sent us, you told us that you first heard of this work at a conference. Is it possible that it was the International Conference on Magnetism in Moscow in 1973? Would that?
That is very likely. I was attending this conference, and there, actually, at this conference, I had also seen Michael Fischer again and had conversations with him on these finite size effects and so on. So, but Spengler did not make a major role at this conference. So it was, there were also some talks being held on Spengler on other conferences at the time, but these were all not such that they really created an extreme excitement.
So when you heard that talk, it was just one of many talks. It didn't stand out as particularly interesting.
Yes.
Is that,
okay. No, the thing which I found particularly interesting and which I felt I would need to work on it was really the talk which was given by Phil Anderson at the stay which I had in 1974 at Bell Labs, because that he really made approximations in the description that it was not important that they really deal with the conduction electrons of the material. It was not important to take this Ruderman-Kittel interaction, which is oscillating and decaying with 1/3 power of distance. So he said it's just important that there is a competition between anti-ferromagnetic and ferromagnetic bonds, and you can assume that there is just a Gaussian distribution of interactions. And for this, he made a mean field approximation. And when I heard this, I got the immediate impression, well, maybe all what he predicts is an artifact of a mean field approximation, and that is also something, a strange kind of phase transition, which one could also study by Monte Carlo. And so when I returned to Germany in fall of 1974, one of the first students which I found to work with me on a diploma thesis, he was Mr. Schröder, and so I asked him, I showed him my Monte Carlo code and told him what he had to do in order to modify to run a spin glass. And then he ran spin glass simulations. And you know, spin glass is, the physics of spin glasses is frustration. And so this student got extremely frustrated because he realized that when he repeated the run, it got quite different results. And so one needed to repeat and repeat again and improve, increase the computing time, and still the results were not very convincing. And but that is somehow the physics of the problem from the point of view of computer simulation. And of course, still the, also in 1974, 75, and so on, the lattice sizes which one could simulate were still quite small, and the length of the runs was still quite short. And so a lot of the results which we got, also they were qualitatively reproducing quite a surprising number of phenomenological findings of the experimentalists qualitatively. And quantitatively results, this was all quite unreliable. But at that time, nobody did realize that really. So the paper found extreme attention. And the student, he was frustrated. He didn't want to stay for a PhD. He went off to doing business. And I got a lot of invited papers at various conferences. So
just before we...
Magnetism conference in Munich, 1979.
Yes, we will get there, I promise. I wanted to get back quickly to your time at Bell Labs. You said you saw a talk by Phil Anderson, right, where he presented the early EA results. Did you talk to Phil Anderson more about this talk, or was it just a talk?
Well, I asked a few questions, but of course, Anderson has a very distinctive way of putting off this question, which it isn't like. And so it was not such that I profited too much from the discussion. But of course, the other clever people which were in the audience, like my host was Pierre Hohenberg, he's a really brilliant scientist, which I have extremely high regard. He unfortunately died a few years ago. He asked much more stringent questions about this, and other people also asked questions. So the whole discussion I found very stimulating, and also the talk. Also, Phil Anderson is not a very well organized speaker, so to say. It was nevertheless extremely stimulating.
So did he share with you a preprint before you left or after you left, or only based on the talk was this enough for you to get started?
At the talk, I did take notes, and I don't really know at which time I got a written version of this paper. I don't remember, but it was since the model to be used was relatively clear. I wanted to study this for the short range case. You don't want to get misled by the mean field approximation anyway, like in critical phenomena. The task was always to find critical exponents beyond mean field by simulation. And so you are not really guided much by knowing the mean field theory at that point when you study a model with the nearest neighbor interaction.
So you mentioned that as soon as you got to Saarbrücken, you know the first student that came to you, that's the project you assigned to him, and that you passed on your code also. So yes. So it was, as you understood, it was a fairly simple modification of the code, so it was a good diploma project in that yes. context. Can you give us an idea of what was the technological landscape at that point? What sort of computational resources or what sort of code you had?
At that time, starting from my PhD work, I was only using codes which I wrote myself. And for a Monte Carlo simulation, straightforward implementation of the Metropolis algorithm on a easing lattice or other sort of nearest neighbor model on a lattice, the code is really quite simple. And of course, it is important that the random number generator is not completely rubbish, so that one always has to test that this is good enough. But this was not an important limitation at that problem either. And I don't know whether you have heard about the saying of Dietrich Stoffer, another Monte Carlo practitioner, somewhat later at that time. He said, "A good Monte Carlo code has no more lines of code than the age of the person who writes it." Yes, yes. So the Monte Carlo code in the most simple version is not a big deal. And of course, the real art about Monte Carlo simulation is really the judgment of what you do and how you analyze the data, and distinguishing what is the real result and what is just, say, an artifact of inappropriate choice of initial condition or something like that. So it's not a big deal of doing a quick Monte Carlo simulation. So this was a good topic for a diploma student.
Yes, and as you mentioned a bit earlier, these results were very well received by the community. There was a lot of interest in those results, which led to you being invited to contribute to various conferences and to also for you to write a brief review of the theory of spin glasses already in 1977, right? And in that work, it shows that you were very clearly following the theoretical discussion on spin glasses that was going on at the same time. So how were you following? Was this mostly through conferences, or were you an avid reader of the scientific literature, or did you have personal...
Well, at that time, it was still, you didn't have the internet. You were still following the literature by going to the library, reading the journals. So this was still a feasible task. The number of journals was much less than it is now. And of course, when you find out about who are the practitioners in the field, it was common at that time to send preprints around and also to send postcards to people from whom you heard, let's say, working and sending, asking to send you some preprints. And so there was a lot of preprints being exchanged. And I remember that in 1979, I did also then find out from preprints by Giorgio Parisi about his work, but I didn't understand it. So I didn't do anything with it because it was quite obscure to me. And I got also at that time the preprints of Bray and Moore, Alan Bray and Michael Moore. I don't know whether you came across those names. They were really at a lot of these conferences, and Giorgio Parisi was not going on any condensed metaphysics conferences at that time, so I didn't meet him in person at that time at all. I only met him much later, and of course, in conferences like the Stadtfis conference in Boston, he gave an invited talk, and in 1992 at the Stadtfis conference in Berlin, where he got the Boltzmann Medal already, he gave an invited talk, and also in Paris he gave at the Stadtfis meeting an invited talk. So I met Parisi mostly at this big prominent conferences, but the small topical meetings which I attended on spin glasses, I think he was not there at the time. And most of these meetings were in the second half of the 70s and in the first years of the 80s. And so there I had a lot of discussion with the colleagues in the field. And so therefore my articles, which I wrote at that time, reflect more or less the state of the art at that time. But of course, when Parisi came, then this was a revolution. And so I had a hard time to catch up. And mostly I succeeded to catch up only through my interaction with Peter Young, who then did also very careful finite size scaling tests of various predictions of the Parisi theory.
So we will get to that. I wanted to step back again because in 1977 also you wrote papers on spin glasses on your own, right? So I was trying to understand, was this because you were particularly excited about the problem at that point, or just because you couldn't find a student?
I was quite excited at that time, and also the field was rapidly developing, and so when you don't have a student, so I also anyway felt that I was young enough, and I better don't forget how it is working by yourself. And so I still, as you may have noticed, in 1985 on this easing model in five dimension and the ramification of finite size scaling above the upper critical dimension, I published a paper just by myself. So this, it's only when you have a very large group. At Jülich, I had a large group, and at Mainz, I then even had a still larger group due to many students. And then you stop doing work by yourself, and it's not a good thing, because working by yourself and just doing everything by yourself on a particular project is useful, and it educates you, and it keeps you also modest and keeps your judgment sound. So I try to be as close to basic work as possible.
So you just mentioned your work in higher dimension. Actually, your first work that in higher dimensions was a collaboration with your postdoc, Dietrich Stauffer, where you looked at spin glasses in dimensions 3, 4, and 5. And at the same time, you also worked with your grad student, Ingo Morgadsen, on the 2D, right? So you were looking at the full spectrum of available data. So clearly this was motivated by the ongoing theoretical discussions in the field about the dimensional dependence of the instability to the spin of the spin glass transition. So first of all, was this the first time that someone did numerical simulations in unphysical dimensions, 4 and 5, for instance?
I'm not sure. It could be that on the percolation problems, this was also done by Dietrich Stauffer by himself. I don't remember exactly when he worked on this, but at some time he worked on this. But since there was the evidence that a renormalization group theory for spin glasses needed to get 6 as a marginal dimension, and if one makes an epsilon expansion for spin glasses, one would need to expand around 6 dimension. And so when this rumor about this fact spread around, then it was, of course, very interesting to try to compare different dimensions. And since in the Monte Carlo evidence, it came out rather clearly from the work which I had done with my student Schröder, that our estimate where there was a transition temperature was clearly too high. And so then when we checked this with more effort, we got a lower number. Other people like Breyer and Moore got a still lower number. So finally, the idea came about that really maybe this was only an effect of the limited observation time. And if one ran an infinite time, the transition would only be at 0 temperature. And that motivated me to try to ask my PhD student Ingo Morgenstern to work on what is a kind of recursive transfer matrix method by which one can, for finite two-dimensional lattices, do an exact static calculation. And that this is a broad force approach, but we could do it for quite a number of lattice sizes, small lattices, and analyze that. And from this work, we got conclusive evidence that in two dimensions, there was no transition, and that really the correlation length of the spin glass was diverging as a kind of power law, presumably, as one approaches 0 temperature. And the correlation function, the spin glass correlation function, was also not converging to the square of an order parameter at 0 temperature, but rather was decaying to 0 with the power law. And so this was in the sort of evidence that 2 was below the so-called lower critical dimension. And actually the discussion of the lower critical dimension went on and on and on still in the current time. So I think there are still papers from this century after the year 2000 which deal with that problem. And I'm not sure whether this is now really proven that it is at 5.5 or whether it is only a conjecture that it is on 5.5.
The discussions are ongoing, as I understand as well.
Yes.
So you've sort of hinted at this already, but I'd like you to elaborate if you can, in a sense that in what way, how was your work received by the theoretical groups in that early stage, so before the Parisi solution, and by the experimental groups, right? Who was the main audience and how were they receiving
that
work?
I think that it was received by both groups with great interest. So the experimentalists were happy because with such Monte Carlo simulations, you could get things like the decay of spin autocorrelation function with the Monte Carlo time, which were similar to the experimental findings. One could also do Monte Carlo simulations of site disorder models, which were closer to the experiment, like this europium sulfide diluted with strontium or related models. One could do relatively realistic simulations. So the experimentalists were interested in getting some guidance in the interpretation of their experiments. And the theorists were, of course, interested, first of all, to know what is really going on in spin glasses with short range forces. And second, also some persons started to simulate also the infinite range model as soon as the Sherrington Kirkpatrick paper was around, which indicated the problems with the simple version of the replica method introduced by Edwards and Anderson. So with Sherrington Kirkpatrick work, this was believed to be exact statistical mechanics. You formulate a model where the interaction between B of spins is independent of distances. You take the mean square interaction has to scale with a number of spins in a way to ensure a sensible thermodynamic limit. And then apart from doing this replica trick, everything is exact. And so then, how could this give a wrong result, like the negative specific heat, which was already found by Sherrington and Kirkpatrick themselves? And this their paper appeared in parallel to my paper with Schroeder. And their first paper appeared in 1975, and our paper, it was submitted in 1975, but it had been circulated around the most people, and so it appeared in 1976. And then Scott Kirkpatrick, he was a simulation person also. He had done very pioneering work on simulations on the percolation problem. And so he then started simulations on the infinite range model. And in the long paper by Sherrington and Kirkpatrick, which came out a few years after their letter, then there were also a comparison with these simulations there. And they also were, as my simulations with Schroeder had a problem of very sluggish and observation time dependent, and it was not clear what was equilibrium and what was not in equilibrium. So this problem appeared in this infinite range case also. And so therefore, the theorists are seeing how difficult this all was, they were all quite interested. And so at these conferences, which I attended in the period from 1977 to 1983, then Alan Bray and Michael Moore were quite regular attendances of the conference, a lot of discussion with them. And they did both simulations and analytical calculation. And also had a lot of exchanges with David Sherrington. So it was a very a very free exchange of ideas and thoughts. And I recall that this was, scientists had a very pleasant way of dealing with each other at that time. It was, and you were not yet, so this was not yet this problem of counting citation numbers and things like that. This was not yet. So the Science Citation Index was not yet the criterion for a person to get a permanent position.
So you describe all this network of people that were interacting at that point, and amongst all of them, you are the one who wrote, I think, the most reviews of the field. You're essentially writing status reports every couple of years. Were you seen as some sort of mediators or central figure that gave you that role?
I think this was the first review which I published in 1977 was just on the basis of an invited talk by a German Physical Society conference. And then I was also invited to winter schools in Norway and to a summer school on fundamental problems and statistical physics. And all these conferences, they wanted to have a book after the conference. And so you were asked to supply an article. And so different people have a different attitude. And some people try to get away with some very lousy short manuscript. And I, when I was asked to write article for these books, then I felt it was useful to have a rather complete write-up. And so these were always more on the longer side and with rather complete references. And so they were then found useful by other people. So that way, I think they found a bit more attention. And this was probably also responsible for the fact that I was asked together with Peter Young to write this review article for Reviews of Modern Physics, which was really like a book because it is almost 200 pages and with two columns, it's and many hundred references, and the people still use it today. So it was a big effort, but it was not completely useless.
We will get there also. It's very interesting work, obviously. So you've mentioned the Parisi solution. When it came out in 1979, you were sent a preprint, but you struggled to understand it. Were you was it mostly confusion, or was there skepticism to with respect to the techniques, or how would you describe your reception?
Well, my original reception was that I just was confused and did not understand it at all. I was understanding so much that the Shearing-Kirkpatrick idea of taking the spin glass order parameter just a constant was inappropriate and that one needed somewhere a broken symmetry. Like even in a ferromagnet, you have a broken symmetry, easing ferromagnet up and down spins, and here it had to be more complicated. But I was not understanding why this construction, which one could find in the Parisi papers, was sensible, and why, and whether what was the reasoning behind it to do quite this and not something else. And a lot of my colleagues had similar difficulties, and so there were always some people questioning whether maybe one could do something else, which would still yield a solution with actually even lower free energy, but these voices are now silent and they disappeared. And now I think the agreement and it's actually proven by this dollar groundwork that this is really the correct answer, and that's it. So it, I have incredible respect for the incredible intuition which Giorgio Parisi had to find this. And I don't know how he really did it to find it. This is a mystery to me, and I don't know whether he explained this to anybody, what led him to do it exactly that way. But it's certainly one of the most intelligent and difficult achievements on theoretical physics of the second half of the 20th century.
So thank you. You had another series of papers that came out about spinning glasses after the Parisi solution came out, about the collaboration with Wolfgang Kinzel on field-cooled and zero-field-cooled simulations. Could you tell us a bit about what inspired this work and what where did it fit?
Well, this was inspired mostly by the interaction with the experimentalists who pointed out that there were these differences in the data, and it was then interesting to find out about it, whether this was also reproduced by the simulation and whether from the simulation one could find some insight in why these differences did occur.
Okay, and I understand these work were very well received as well, in theory. Did you follow a bit the response to those papers, or?
Not really, because when I had found with Ingo Morgenstern that in two dimensions there was no spin glass transition, and then it trying to clarify now what happens in three dimensions turned out to be increasingly difficult. And actually my PhD student Ingo Morgenstern, after he had made his PhD with summa cum laude and so on, he became postdoc at the University of Heidelberg in Heinz Horner's group, also a spin glass theorist at that time. And then he had the opportunity to also spend the time at Bell Laboratories, and there he worked with Ogielski, and Ogielski had built a special purpose computer. And on this special purpose computer, dedicated just to do spin glass simulations only. And then that was the first believable results for the transition in the plus minus J spin glass. And actually it turns out that the estimate which came out from there, the freezing temperature, it was only around 8% too high according to what one believes now is the correct answer. But the critical exponent nu, which he estimated, is already a factor of 2. So this shows that even with such an effort at that time, you did not get sound results, quantitatively results that stand up the criticism of time for a long while. And I felt I would not try to find somebody who builds for me a special purpose computer so that I can stay in that race. So I felt after I had suffered a lot from this review article with Peter Young, which we actually wrote in the years 1983, 1984, and submitted in 1985, and it came out in 1986. And so then I was really tired of continuing to work on spin glasses and felt I should do something else, and leave the competition to others who could do a better job. And it turned out that again, Giorgio Parisi, he was the mastermind behind this Janus collaboration, a special purpose computer. I think it is physically located in Spain. And the papers which result from this collaboration set gave now the most precise numbers for the spin glass critical temperature and the spin glass exponents. But when you look on the author list of the paper, 24 authors on one paper, it's like a high energy physics collaboration. So this was not my style of working. And so I didn't try to compete, because building a really good special purpose computer is a huge project in itself. It is a kind of engineering project, and you need a dedicated team who can do that, and I didn't see how I could compete on that count.
Understandably. So, to go back to that magnum opus, right, the paper with Peter Young, could you tell us a bit how this idea came about and how did you get to work? Because I don't think you had ever collaborated with Peter Young before that, right? So this was a new joint effort.
Peter Young was one of the persons who was regularly present at the same conferences as I. So we had a lot of discussions, and the idea to do this together was when we found out that the two of us had both received invitations from the journal, and then we decided we better join forces, and it was a lot of work anyway, and a complete coverage of both experiment, simulation, and the analytical theories was such a big task. I didn't understand really how big the task was, because only when I had started working, then I was trying to really look on all the papers which existed in the field in order to make sure I'm not unfair to anybody who had made an important contribution. And so Xerox copies of articles piled up, and then distinguishing which was relevant and which was only a kind of little decoration to something which was already spelled out well enough and need not really be covered. That was a lot of effort, and so it was nice to have a co-author to talk about this and to exchange opinions, and for a single person giving such a judgment of contributions of many, many, many other authors is a delicate matter, and it's much better to have and Peter Young is a very fine character, a very nice person, and really a good friend, and so we could do this very well together.
Because this work is actually not only a work of synthesis and curation, but it also was a pedagogical effort involved, right? You've mentioned that you had to teach yourself Parisi's works and then be able to explain it.
Yes. It's just giving a list who did what. That is not a good review, I think.
Absolutely. But did you ever get to reuse that material after putting it together? Did you get to teach a course that used ideas of replica symmetry breaking, for instance, either at the university or in summer schools?
At the university, we later had a research effort on amorphous materials and classes at the University of Mainz. And I was a spokesman of this collaborative research effort between theorists, experimentalists, and chemists. And in that context, I was giving a course on the statistical mechanics of disordered materials. And that has a section on percolation in it and a section on spin glasses in it and on undercooled fluids and so on. And this course that became later the nucleus of the book which I wrote together with Walter Koop. I'm not sure whether you are aware of that book, but this book, which is more recent, and that then of course gives also contains the more recent spin glass literature, but of course it is not as complete as this article, but it rather tries to focus on the things which are really important in retrospect after some time. But that is all what I did. I was not planning to write another review article or book on the subject of spin glasses only. So the one with Peter Young was so much effort, and I think I didn't want to have this again.
So just to situate us, when would this course would have started? This is the mid-90s or early 90s? And the course in Mainz,
started in the early 90s, because the special research program on classes started in 1987 or 1986. It was conceived in 1987. The German National Science Foundation funded it. And so this meant I got additional postdoc position and got more possibilities to hire PhD students. And so then it was always a good idea when you have such a research program to have some accompanying teaching activities also. And of course, this course was not given only once, but it was given several times. And after it had been given several times, and actually Walter Kopp, at that, he is now in Pompelier, but at that time he was at Mainz. And I conceived the idea that we could have a book on this matter. And I think this book I'm also quite happy to, although it has not such a great popularity still, but I think it's still, from my point of view, I find it quite complete and useful.
Yes. So as you said, you started being interested, as you left the world of spinning glasses, you moved into the world of structural glasses with the creation of that program. And I've read that part of the motivation was the development of Goetze's mode coupling theory. Is that correct? And if yes, could you elaborate?
Well, the Goetze mode coupling theory had existed at the time when we conceived this program, and it was not the main motivation for conceiving this program, but really this program was conceived mainly under the initiative of experimentalists who felt that it was important to have some coherent effort in this area where theorists and experimentalists and chemists work together and try to achieve some feature of Gauss fertilization among our joint research effort to avoid that we just get stuck in mediocre work. And in fact, this research effort was quite successful. And also, after 15 years, this program ran, and we had many conferences organized, and the participants in this program played a major role at these class conferences, which were entitled Relaxations in Complex Systems, which were held in Greece by Kia Nagai from Naval Research Laboratories in the United States. He was the main organizer of these conferences. And then so we had there a rich exchange with the international community of people working on the structural glass transition. And the structural glass transition is still rather controversial until today, because there are a lot of experimentalists who don't like any of these spin glass motivated approaches. They don't like the Goetze mode coupling theory. They are still concerned with ideas about the free volume and how it is distributed in the supercooled fluid. And so there are many of the old ideas from glass research, which date back decades ago, which are still alive. And some people still try to work on that basis and analyze their data with that. And it is unfortunately effect that the more analytical work on theory of classes has not contributed such a broad understanding and common agreement about what is going on as in the spin glass field. So in the spin glass field, there are now, even quite recently, there are physical review letter papers where experiments on spin glasses are interpreted, which concepts explaining the aging phenomena which one observes. And the theoretical concepts are really motivated by the analytical theory which has been before. And this sort of close linkage between theory and experiment in the field of the structural gas transition, I'm afraid, has not been reached yet. And whether it will be reached and when, I don't know. But it's still an interesting field.
Speaking of the connection between spin glasses and structural glasses, at about the same time as you started your program in Mainz, Kirkpatrick, Termalai, and Wolnist used inspiration from pot spin glasses to formulate a theory of structural glasses. Did you follow these developments? Was this also a sort of inspiration for you at the time, or did it come later on?
No, this was certainly one of the concepts which I found very interesting, and we thought of, is there something how one can prove this or disprove this? And of course, there was always in the glass transition the idea of looking for some glass correlation links. And I was, the attempts which I was involved is we're trying to look on the correlation links from surface effects, preparing walls with rough walls with the smooth walls for the same model, and then looking how the dynamics was influenced as a function of temperature for these different types of wall, and whether one could extract the correlation length from this. And there were also these ideas about the same time of looking for this string-like object in glasses. And so many of these ideas were there. But concerning drawing conclusions about the concept of this Termalai and Wolnist concepts, I didn't see that this was really proving or disproving much of it. And the problem is, of course, that always the simulation on the glassy models were not yet possible at low enough temperatures, so that one was really clear that one was deep enough in the glass phase to still see something which relates to the free energy landscape of the glass. So as long as you are in the regime which is describable by the mode coupling theory, it is clear that one is still far above the glass transition. And then the relaxation times get already very long, and so then it's difficult to make sure to that one can interpret the simulations properly. So,
but you have a lot of experience in that particular problem, right?
Yes, but I must say I don't claim that I have solved the problem. So,
so is there any other way? So okay. Clearly, there's a relationship between your work on spin glasses and your work on structural glasses. But as your work on spin glasses influenced the rest of your research program in any other way that we have not talked about, that maybe in more subtle
the
ways?
The immediate step which I took were not the standard structural glasses, but we went to what was called the orientational glasses. So when you dilute molecular crystals which were in molecular crystals, you have ordered due to the quadrupole moments of the crystals, like in, say, solid nitrogen, the quadrupole moments of the nitrogen molecule are oriented. And when you dilute such a nitrogen crystal with argon, which is just a spherical atom, no quadrupole moment, then also a sort of glass phenomenon occurs, and the phase diagram looks quite similar to the phase diagrams of spin glass systems. And so then we try to study models for these orientational glasses. And that, yeah, we are, when I moved into this, there were not yet any other work around. So it was then just possible to do some first exploratory studies with relatively modest computer resources and not the need of starting already with a special purpose computer for that purpose. And so I worked a couple of years in the late 80s and beginning of 90s still on that problem.
At the institutional level, So, did working in the spinning glass problem change the statistical mechanics community in Europe, for instance? Can you draw a difference before 1975 and after 1985 based on that, on the intense collaboration that you've described, or was it always like this?
Well, I don't think that the general structure of the community did change. And so some of the prominent practitioners did get positions, like Wolfgang Kienzler got professor first at Gießen, and then he moved on to Würzburg. And Annette Tsipelius, I should have mentioned her name anyway, because her work with Zombolinski on the dynamical approach to spin glass theory was really very influential for quite a number of years. She got a position at the University of Göttingen and so on. So there were quite a number of people then building up a community. But of course, there were other fields getting popular. So fractal Gauss and Kader-Parisi-Zank equation was a very famous topic for a while, and then soft matter came up, and that is now one with active liquids biology. So theoretical physics and statistical mechanics in Germany is a very diverse community which has many subfields, and spin glasses was one of them.
Okay. Speaking of the relationship between the communities, one very close community, at least from your standpoint, was that working on percolation at the same time. Dietrich Stauffer, most maybe prominently bridged the two. Was there a lot of crosstalk, or were these understood to be completely different problems and different methods and different ideas?
Well, there were certainly a lot of crosstalk for several reasons. The percolation was also a problem where the upper critical dimension being six, so it's also some Quench disorders, and one could also find many different variants of percolation which were mostly suitably studied by computer simulations. So from a computer simulation perspective, this was very natural to have interaction on percolation.
Okay, so but you didn't leverage that yourself, or your collaborators mostly used the convenience of the same Monte Carlo codes, I guess, or other resources.
Well, I Dietrich Stauffer was for a while in my group, and he pioneered this, and I found this extremely valuable, and so I tried to support him as much as I could. And he was quite a special character, so to say. So he had not such an easy time as I had in finding a permanent position. And so I certainly didn't try to steal him any ideas or anything. So rather let him do what he wanted and not get my name attached to what he was doing. And so I avoided. So he was very nice collaborator on certain spin glass papers, but I tried to let the percolation field just for himself.
We're nearing the end of the interview, so I wanted to give the chance to Francesco in case there's any question you wanted to ask as well.
Yes. Hello.
Thank you. I'm following with much attention, but I don't have any question to add.
So in again, closing, getting to the end, is there anything else that you would like to share with us about this epoch that we may have missed or skipped over? Or some concluding thoughts?
Well, I think we have touched a lot of issues, and it would be very nice if the field of spin glasses and glasses is still flourish in the near future and if its practitioners continue to find great recognition. And so let's hope that this will be the case.
We hope so too. Finally, do you have any, have you kept notes, paper, correspondence from that epoch? And if you did, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Well, I'm afraid not, because the correspondence which I had altogether was huge and on many different issues and in quite a chaotic state. And when I had to give up my office as a full professor in 2012 and move to a small office, then a lot of the paper, which I felt was not of real interest, I was simply going to a waste paper container, and it turned out that not a single waste paper container, because I still had all these preprints kept. And so all these reprints, and so I did keep part of this material, but not on spin glasses, because that I didn't plan to do any further work. I still, you may find some recent work from myself on a certain problem with semi-flexible polymers and stuff like that. And so I kept a lot of papers on polymer simulation and theoretical polymer physics, but not on spin glasses. So it's in the past.
Yes.
There were much less activities and much less papers, and I did not think that anybody would be interested in the mess of papers which is left over for me at some point. So
I understand, and you're, many people have done the same. So Professor Binder, thank you so much for your time and for your thoughts. It's been a real pleasure to hear about your work and that very special time in which you did it.
Yeah, it was a very lucky time, really. So at that time, when you, I have said it, you could go to the library, you could sneak through the journals, scanning over all the important journals in an afternoon, and then you knew quite for a while what was going on. And but now it is completely impossible. So this, with all these preprint servers and journals, it's impossible. So this, simply the large number of scientists who work now make it really very difficult to make visible contributions. It was much easier in the 60s and 70s of last century. So I was really a member of a still lucky generation, not as lucky as the people before the Second World War, but still lucky enough to be able to do some interesting work.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.